the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for clicking on the Peter B. Collins Show. Some powerful voices coming your way, and I hope you'll share this podcast with a friend. My thanks to Cameron Troxell, Susan Fellows, Eugene Kenny, and Carl Hesterberg. They're voluntary subscribers to the PBC show. If you're able and you'd like to, and you can help, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. Click on the link on the right. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. Up first today, the voice of a former Guantanamo prisoner. Life after Gitmo, it's another level of hell. Also on today's program, Shahid Buttar. He's executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Comments on the recent FBI raids and the creeping police state in this country. And we have an interesting listener email to share with you as well. Also, Colonel Ann Wright returns to tell the story of the Israeli attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla on May 31st. And the trial of the Creech 14 in Nevada. And we'll end the show with a commentary from Will Durst. Recently, I had a conversation with a former Guantanamo prisoner who was held for nearly 10 years without charge and without knowing if he would ever be released. We'll call him Abdul. In the past year, Abdul has been released to one of 16 countries that have agreed to host the innocent people that we held and, in many cases, subjected to torture. As you will hear, life after Guantanamo is very difficult. While I believe that the U.S. offers some compensation to these host countries for taking the victims of our detention and torture program, it's either inadequate or the resources do not actually reach the former prisoners. Here's Abdul.
After we've been held in Guantanamo Bay for approximately 10 years, and after we lost 10 years from our life there in brutal torture, the Americans just took us and threw us in two different countries, and they found like countries for the others, and they threw them, and they don't really care what is going to happen to them after that. The life after Guantanamo, I believe, is harder than Guantanamo itself. I will not say it's a torture, because really it is freedom, but freedom without any any kind of help. The American has decided to do a program with other governments. That's what they ask the other governments to do. And I don't really believe there's anything from that program is applied today by any means.
Now, Abdul, do you know if the United States government provided any resources, including money, to the governments that agreed to take you and host you after you were released from Guantanamo? And if the U.S. gave them money, is the money being used properly on your behalf?
I have such as this information, and I have heard myself from many other former detainees in other countries that the government themselves, they said the American has supported the governments to help the former detainees in their own lives, but in spending those money in education, in spending those money in helping a person to find a job, to learn a job, to work, and to find a way for this person to for spending for his house, for also to helping him in his healthcare, in his home needs, and such as these things. And also the most important thing is to help him to build his family. But the reality, there is none of these at all.
Abdul connected me with another former detainee who has been sent to a different country, who we will call Hakim. Hakim left Guantanamo with very serious health problems resulting from Rumsfeld's enhanced interrogation techniques. In Hakim's case, it's the result of exposure to extreme heat and cold. In his new country, he received initial medical care, but surgery to ease his condition was botched. He reports that his health coverage has been cut off. He has to pay higher prices for medicines than citizens of the host country. He's unable to work and only has enough money each month to buy food for about 15 to 20 days. Abdul says, and I quote through the translation, "It started after he was tortured at Guantanamo and subjected to very cold conditions. It caused a long and very serious infection, and he received no treatment at Guantanamo. When he was moved to the new country, doctors said it had caused very big swelling. The doctor decided to perform surgery. Alas, the surgery was made with mistake." Hakim now has great difficulty breathing. Quote, "He can't breathe very well. The doctor knew he made a mistake, but did not tell Hakim. Then he got a big infection and almost died with it. After 3 months, another doctor told him the surgery was done incorrectly." Then this person who got this condition at Guantanamo because of being treated with extreme cold, and that's one of the torture techniques that was used in this tropical climate, he then went to where improper surgery was performed, and this has left him with permanent damage and an inability to breathe properly. Is that all correct?
Yes, you are absolutely right. And this is not only a permanent damage. It is every day subjected to die, every day, or subjected to death because of this.
The new doctor says Hakim needs more surgery, or he could die any day. Quote, "Since the botched operation, his health care has been cut off, and he has been told to buy medications with his own money, which is not even enough for food. He has to pay higher rates than residents of the country and goes begging when he runs out of money." His handlers in the host country warned him not to contact the U.S. Embassy, so he thinks nobody at the American Embassy knows about him. There's more to this story, but as you can imagine, the former detainees are very concerned that any attention could actually make their situations worse. I will keep you posted as I learn more.
It's the Peter B. Collins Show, and we are recording live in the People's Republic of Berkeley today. And there is a very impressive panel of many people who have appeared on the Peter B. Collins Show who are here at the law school, the Bolt Law School at the University of California, Berkeley, as part of Berkeley Says No to Torture. And I think this is a very important effort, and it's seriously undercovered by the corporate media in this country. One of the people who we've talked to before who is participating in this event is Shahid Buttar. And I'm going to ask him if I pronounced his name properly, because last time he was just so kind and didn't mention it until the very end of the interview. Welcome, and how am I doing?
Thank you so much, and you nailed it. That was perfect. Thanks.
Shahid Buttar. And he's the executive director of the board, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and that's BORDC.org on the web. And when we spoke before, Shahid, I was very impressed with the range of issues that you're covering and your commitment to a nonpartisan return to constitutional rule here in these United States. And you and I were scheduled to speak a couple of weeks ago, and then I developed pneumonia, and so I'm glad to have this opportunity to meet you face-to-face and to talk about what I wanted to discuss that had just broken a couple of weeks ago. In a coordinated raid early in the morning, the FBI made assaults on the homes of peace activists in both Minneapolis and Chicago. And they did not arrest the individuals, but it seems like a case of hazing and harassment to me. And they did serve, I think, warrants or subpoenas and collected computers and leaflets and other printed materials of these private individuals. And I see this as a dangerous extension of the creep that started with the Patriot Act, that was extended by the last Bush Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, in some orders that he issued without any congressional review during his final months in office in 2008. I see this as part of a creeping police state, and I'm very disappointed that this has occurred under the watch of President Obama. Give us a quick summary of these raids, the kinds of individuals who were targeted, and the status of these efforts right now.
Absolutely, and you're right to be concerned about it. The FBI raids were essentially of anti-war activists throughout the Midwest. Minneapolis and Chicago were the two geographic centers where most of the people were who were raided. Many of the subpoenas that were issued during those raids referred to and sought communications with a particular individual who I happen to work with from time to time in Chicago at the Arab American Action Network. The theory, at least, in the advocacy community, as far as we know it, is that these subpoenas aim to discover information that would be prosecuted on the basis that they constituted expert advice, which has been criminalized by the Patriot Act, upheld by the Humanitarian Law Project case in the Supreme Court this spring. And it really represents, you're right to be concerned about this, the erosion of the First Amendment and the criminalization of what used to be constitutionally protected speech. The one bright spot, I'll say, in this story is that the subpoenas were essentially rescinded this week. The defense team for some of those folks does not necessarily know if this is the end of this or perhaps an indication of more to come. But it is worth noting that in the 3 weeks after the raids, there were demonstrations in 50 different cities. And, you know, I do hold out some hope that this was an example of popular mobilization acquainting the administration with its political interests heading into the midterm elections.
Now, you're the attorney here, but my reading of this is that this is an expansion of the already murky concept of material support, and that by advocating for the rights of the Palestinian people, advocating for the rights of Muslims who are subject to American occupation in Iraq or Afghanistan, that this can be turned on its ear and at least pursued on a legal theory, that by making these free speech statements and advocating for the rights of oppressed people, that this somehow is a violation of the zeitgeist of the war on terror.
That's absolutely right. And the one gloss or, you know, perhaps caveat I'd suggest is that it's not actually an extension. This, unfortunately, is where the material support standard has been, in that the Humanitarian Law Project case, for instance, the one where the Supreme Court upheld a very aggressive interpretation of the material support standard, it upheld the criminal prosecution of a group that was promoting nonviolent conflict resolution in Turkey. Right, so not war on terror related, so closely at least, and absolutely not at all related to militant activity. If anything, aimed very squarely at trying to reduce it, and that has been criminalized. So it's not even the case necessarily that any particular set of political interest has been impacted, but the material support standard does basically give the executive branch the opportunity to declare any particular political clause, criminal, and prosecute speech in support of it. It is a direct assault on, you know, one of the very fundamental underpinnings of our constitutional fabric.
One of the types of change that I was hopeful for, and I carefully calibrated and downgraded my expectations, but I really expected that Obama and his Attorney General, Eric Holder, would take a look at the offenses that have already been admitted to. Number one, that the FBI has repeatedly abused the so-called national security letters and then the no-knock warrant that Mukasey imposed, which essentially says that any FBI agent with a certain suspicion can act on that, and that doesn't require checking with a judge, receiving any kind of Fourth Amendment required court order for search and seizure under probable cause. And I thought that because the Inspector General had exposed these abuses, that we would see some sort of reining in of this kind of cowboy law enforcement behavior that is aimed at groups who simply oppose the policies of our government.
You'd hope so, and unfortunately it hasn't yet been the case. And the story with the Holder Justice Department, unfortunately, is ripe with disappointments and across multiple dimensions. So you're right to note the NSLs, the national security letters, which in at least three different instances, the Inspector General of the Justice Department has found to have been abused wantonly, systemically, on the scale of tens of thousands of improper requests. And there's been, not only has there been no attempt to curtail those abuses, but there in fact is now an effort with the White House's support to extend those abuses by giving the FBI an even greater sphere of authority with NSLs to, without a judicial warrant, gain, on a whim, access to electronic transaction data. So email metadata, to-from information, how long an email is, if there was an attachment, what time it was sent. You can infer a lot from this sort of data, especially when it's data mined and aggregated. Also web browsing history. So again, not only has the Holder Justice Department not held accountable the Bureau for its historical abuses, but it's actually giving it further authority to commit more abuses going forward. And even that, unfortunately, is just the tip of an iceberg, right? I'm here in Berkeley this week primarily to talk at a series of events about torture, and that's another area in which the Holder Justice Department has been, despite the nominal independence of the Attorney General from the President's absolutely appalling stance to allow torture with impunity, and there has been a very limited investigation announced into some of the junior-level CIA agents who approved the techniques of, authorized by the Office of Legal Counsel under the Bush administration. There's been no effort at all to address the senior decision-makers who are responsible for that policy, and in fact, the Holder Justice Department was the agency that, after deciding in an initial draft of an investigation by the Office of Professional Responsibility that many of the OLC lawyers who approved the torture memos were essentially culpable for intentional professional misconduct, then allowed those same lawyers an extraordinary access. Of course, I've been there. Allowed extraordinary access by the lawyers who were subjects of that investigation to essentially edit the report. And John Yu, who teaches here at UC Berkeley, basically revised the memo in his favor to conclude that he and Judge Jay Bybee, who preposterously holds a lifetime appointment to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, did not, in fact, commit professional misconduct, but merely poor judgment. That, again, reflects the politicization of the Justice Department in a way that is really troubling. And, you know, the last thing I'd say here is that beyond torture and the national security letters, the Bureau in particular is run amok. And there's nothing that the Holder Justice Department has done to constrain it. The Attorney General's guidelines, which you noted, which were revised in late 2008, there's been no effort in the Justice Department to revise those guidelines, even though they basically took what remained of the post-Watergate protections and shredded them. And so we're now back under the legal standard that allowed COINTELPRO to happen. The raids that you mentioned in the Midwest of the anti-war activists has a disturbing relevance to the kinds of abuses that the FBI undertook in the 50s and 60s, which the Church Committee in the Senate described as a, quote, sophisticated vigilante operation aimed squarely at the suppression of legitimate First Amendment rights.
Well, and Shahid, one of the participants that I'm looking forward to seeing in this event that we will attend this evening is Jeffrey Hass, who was the attorney who represented the survivors of Fred Hampton, the Black Panther leader who was gunned down by police in Chicago in 1968. And I worked in Chicago on radio there starting in 1972. And I covered part of the effort to bring the federal government to justice over that state-sponsored assassination. And it's important to note the continuity, because many people think of COINTELPRO as a brief aberration in American history. But when you link it to the McCarthy era, and then the persecution of black leaders, not limited to those thought extreme like the Black Panthers, but we now know that the official photographer for Martin Luther King was a longtime FBI informant. And then we move forward, there appeared to be a period of less of this type of intrusive, unconstitutional behavior following Watergate. But with the provocation of 9/11, we saw them swing right into action, jam through the Patriot Act that none of the members of Congress had read, expanding these police authorities in a breathtaking manner. And now we are seeing, in these different circumstances that we're talking about, the implementation of the same kind of, I can only use the word fascist, behavior by our government.
Unfortunately, you're absolutely right. And I call the FBI a recidivist agency because it is. The Bureau has, over multiple periods of time, grown sullied with this sort of behavior. You can go back to several points in history, the McCarthy era, the COINTELPRO era, the Palmer raids were supported by the precursor agencies to the FBI. I don't think the Bureau in its present form actually existed at that time. But this phenomenon of politicized what passes for law enforcement unfortunately recurs. And it's interesting to note the times at which it recurs. And, you noted correctly that after the Watergate era, this stuff really subsided. And that's predictable because there were laws put in place, right? In 1976, it was that the Attorney General then, Edward Leavy, in order to stave off congressional intervention, unilaterally imposed restrictions on the Bureau. That was the first set of the Attorney General's guidelines that have been watered down periodically ever since. And since 9/11, there have been two sets of revisions, in 03 by then Attorney General Ashcroft, and then in 08 by Attorney General Mukasey. And there haven't been any revisions from the Holder Justice Department. I would hope that at some point the Justice Department will revisit this. I don't have a great deal of confidence that it would actually revise the guidelines in any helpful direction. It's an interesting story to tell about the guidelines being passed essentially over congressional objections. And if you trace the history of this policy, it was originally introduced to keep Congress from acting. It's been watered down since, so that the need now for Congress to act recurs. And despite the fact that Congress is generally dysfunctional, there was still some energy in Congress to try to subject this latest revision to some sort of scrutiny and process. I'll just tell you a quick story. I sued the FBI in 2008 to get a copy of its policy implementing the Attorney General's guidelines. The standard under which the FBI is currently conducting infiltration operations is secret, known neither to the public nor Congress. And I certainly understand the need for potential surveillance operations to be secret. I don't understand how in a country that purports to lead the free world, the legal standard can be secret. Secret laws are not democratic. They are not transparent. They are offensive, period. And when you see them implemented in the way that, for instance, in the raids in the Midwest, or in the story, there have been a rash of stories about GPS devices being found by unsuspecting people in their cars planted by the FBI or local law enforcement, often without warrants. That also is offensive and unfortunately predictable in the wake of the guidelines being eviscerated.
And I wanted to give an update to our listeners because it was just a few months ago that I interviewed a former Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of Mississippi, Oliver Diaz. And he had been representing John McTiernan, who's pretty well known. He's a Hollywood director, and his biggest films were Die Hard and Hunt for Red October, Thomas Crown Affair, and Predator. And he got caught up in a situation where the story is he had just flown in from Asia. He was at home. He'd had a couple of drinks. He'd taken a sleeping pill to try to help his jet lag. The phone rings, and it's an FBI agent who's asking him questions that he didn't want to answer. And he the issue relates way back to the Clinton era with a private investigator in Los Angeles named Anthony Pelicano, who was hired by various people, and he apparently broke the law in wiretapping people's phones and using intimidation. But here McTiernan simply answered the phone. An FBI agent asked him if he had ever hired Anthony Pelicano, and he said no. Well, he was not prepared for this. He had not been served with any notice whatsoever. And so he, on the advice of attorneys, I think including the former Justice Diaz, he pled guilty to two charges. And the judge really hit him hard. and sentenced him to a full year in federal prison. The quote from the Associated Press story here, U.S. District Judge Dale Fisher had no sympathy, saying a prison sentence will no longer give McTiernan the ability to eat aged cheeses, cured meats, or red wine. And this kind of hard-nosed activity, based on a very flimsy charge, which essentially was taking advantage of the fact that this man chose to answer the phone instead of letting the FBI call go to voicemail. And this strikes me as a very political kind of prosecution. And this is a wealthy, influential white male. So I just want to point out that while activists and political people who are sometimes on the fringe might be seen as the primary targets, that this is very pervasive, even into communities where you would expect he's got the juice to fix this before he got sent to federal prison.
Yeah, on the one hand, I would have to say I'm relieved that it's at least equal opportunity oppression, right? So I'm glad that economic privilege does not offer an escape hatch or a get out of jail free card. Though I would say, having said that, that lying to a federal officer, the charge to which Mr. McTiernan pled guilty, is the most common charge in counterterrorism investigations. The second most is material support, which is where we started with the raids in the Midwest. I could tell another story about a lying to a federal officer charge out of Southern California, which has had a recent update. This relates to, I suppose it was late 2007, I think, when reports from a series of Muslims in Southern California that there was an individual promoting violence inside their houses of worship, their mosques, it became clear after a whistleblower, So in late 2007, reports emerged from Los Angeles of a series of mosques in which someone was going around promoting violence. It turns out that person was an FBI informant, an ex-convict, paid $100,000. Craig Montiel was his name. He went public blowing a whistle on his FBI handlers. One of the individuals who had reported the informant's activities to the authorities, as you want people to do, right? That's the right answer. If someone's promoting violence, you report it to the authorities. The individual who submitted the report was then prosecuted for lying to a federal officer because when asked about his international trips, he listed them, and one of his trips didn't make the list. And it's the trivial nature of these omissions and their criminalization that is particularly disturbing.
Let's pause and let Jason in. Yeah, good. We're still talking, but come on in.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, no, no. We can edit. So, Shahid, is there anything happening in terms of efforts to rein in these extra-legal procedures that we're talking about here that, in my view, clearly violate the Constitution and are not only condoned and tolerated, but now promoted by a Democratic administration? What's developing to try to deal with this kind of surveillance and other things that appear to violate the Fourth Amendment?
There are a lot of actions around the country, and I think that it's important to note that while the Constitution, as we understand it, is supposed to find protection by the federal judiciary, we can't rely on it anymore. The judiciary has basically shredded the Fourth Amendment. The 14th Amendment is a shadow of its former self. After the Humanitarian Law Project case, especially when contrasted with Citizens United, the only people who get First Amendment protections are corporations who aren't people. So the federal judiciary is no longer an effective arena to defend the Constitution. And I would go so far as to say that the federal courts lack any legitimacy, especially in the context of mass incarceration for people of color, while politically connected war criminals, you know, are awarded seats in the federal judiciary. So the can gets kicked down the road, particularly to local governments. And there are a lot of opportunities in local government to raise rights above the federal floor. And we see this happening in communities across the country. For instance, on both coasts, on the East Coast and on the West Coast, different city councils, Hartford, Connecticut, Berkeley, California, have introduced a local civil rights restoration act, which aims to do several things. While the FBI cannot be constrained by local laws, local police can. And the FBI relies to a large extent on cooperation of local police, collecting information without suspicion feeding that intelligence into federal databases, which then get disseminated to fusion centers, joint terrorism task forces, the Director of National Intelligence, what have you. So while we can't stop the FBI and city councils, we can stop the Mayberry Police Department, we can stop the Hartford Police Department, the Springfield Police Department from participating in and extending these sorts of abuses. And what this act basically does is require reasonable suspicion of criminal activity for there to be any intelligence collection or monitoring. That shouldn't be controversial, right? The Fourth Amendment says that there will be no unreasonable searches and seizures and that warrants shall not issue except upon probable cause, which is a much more demanding standard. The fact that reasonable suspicion is even supposed to be a restrictive standard at all reflects just how far we've fallen, that the Fourth Amendment essentially has not been operating for the last 10 years. The authorities have been just systematically disregarding it as if it weren't even in the Constitution, despite their oaths to defend it. The other thing that this bill does, and I think this is interesting, is that it includes a data reporting requirement so that local police have to collect, analyze, and then disclose on an annual basis statistics that demonstrate the demographics of people who are stopped, searched, arrested, people subjected to force. So this is a transparency provision to basically establish an empirical trail as to what local police are doing. And then the final piece, and this is of particular interest to Latino communities, is a block on information sharing with ICE. So it's a way of blocking both the 287G program, under which local police enforce federal immigration law, as well as the Secure Communities Initiative, under which local arrest data is transmitted to ICE. And just to, you know, tie the bow here, the point very much of these reforms is to help synthesize a coherent voice for civil liberties, civil rights coalition that includes African Americans, Latino Americans, Muslim Americans, South Asian Americans, Arab Americans, and Caucasian Americans who care about privacy. All of these groups together share an interest in the Fourth Amendment. We can't rely on the courts to do it, but we can win in the city councils. And this last thing I'd say here is that while Congress is shut down, for a variety of reasons, collection of action dilemmas, barriers to access, just the fact that there are so many people in the body that even if you're able to get to a congressperson and convince them to support any measure of, you know, number of reforms, they then face a pretty high hurdle in terms of having to convince their colleagues. City council people are easily accessible, right? They don't normally have staff, so policy suggestions are usually quite welcome. They're quite accessible. You don't need 50 people or 10,000 signatures to get in their office. You can usually just walk down the street and walk in. And once you get their support, they only have to convince 10 or 12 people instead of 2 or 300. So I think the greatest opportunities to defend the Constitution are really in cities and towns across the country in the city halls that I think people usually take for granted.
Let me just add two things to what you just said. One is that the Fourth Amendment is an unambiguous declarative sentence. Unlike the Second Amendment, where they've split hairs arguing over what that militia thing meant, the Fourth Amendment has no fuzziness in it whatsoever, and it pains me that it is so widely abused. And secondly, I would argue that you're a little bit too generous to the Congress. The Democratic majority may not be able to pass bills over the obstructionist Republicans in many cases, but the chairs have the right to conduct very aggressive oversight. And they have been neutered with the White House and the triple majority that the Democrats enjoy right now. And while I don't wish for a shift in those majorities for many other reasons, it's very important to note that this Congress is incredibly lame in asserting its rights of oversight and investigation of the very issues that we're talking about. Shahid, sure.
So just to take, you know, what you said there and take it a step further, the Senate Judiciary Committee has, to its credit and the credit of Chairman Leahy, attempted a modicum of oversight. I'll just tell a quick story from an oversight hearing at the end of July in which the FBI Director, Robert Mueller, testified. So Mueller is asked by Chairman Leahy in this hearing, what is the use of race in investigations? And Mueller says, well, race is not enough. There has to be more. There has to be some kind of act. And so then Leahy says, so you have to have suspicion before you initiate a surveillance operation. And Mueller says, yes, we have to have suspicion. Well, it's interesting that after the cameras are off, after the microphones are turned off, that afternoon, the FBI sends a note to the Senate Judiciary Committee saying, oh, sorry, that was a mistake. We don't actually need suspicion. We knew that the FBI didn't need evidence. That was what the 2008 Mukasey guidelines said, that you don't have to have evidence. You don't need a factual predicate to initiate an investigation. And remember, the standard under which undisclosed participation or undercover infiltration takes place is secret. In this oversight hearing, when the Senate did attempt to oversee it, the FBI director basically just lied to Congress. And the interesting thing to me about this hearing in particular was that the dominant coverage of the hearing talked about a recurring problem with FBI agents lying on their exams because they don't know the limits of their own powers. It strikes me as particularly interesting that neither the agents on the front line nor the director know the limits of their own powers. And when the agents and the director don't know the limits of their powers, it's pretty predictable that those powers will be abused. And I do think that there is an ongoing story here about executive aggrandizement, the impotence of Congress in trying to rein it in, and even when, in the limited instances, Congress does display an interest in attempting to do this, even under the Obama administration, it's like a bob and weave maneuver where the executive just hides the ball, you know, make lies before the committees, and then submits notes after the cameras are off, admitting to just pervasive constitutional violations. There's no way of reading the Fourth Amendment that permits surveillance even without suspicion. That is just a bald-faced flipping of the document, right? I mean, it's always required some kind of suspicion. You have to have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity even to stop someone on the street and pat them down for weapons. And the FBI claims the authority to do so much more than that. Infiltrate organizations, you know, even potentially under the proposed rule changes, access electronic transaction data with no suspicion at all. And it just makes no sense.
Shahid Buttar with us from the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And just briefly, I want to turn to two other subjects, Shahid. One is that it's widely known that the Obama administration has targeted for assassination an American citizen named Anwar al-Awlaki. He is now living in Yemen, and he has been tied circumstantially to the shooting incident at Fort Hood, Texas last November, and to the underpants bomber, the Nigerian Abdul Muttalib, who was on that flight going into Detroit on Christmas of 2009. And while those are sensational connections that have been made, they're about as persuasive as the way that Attorney General, before Gonzalez, Ashcroft, attempted to convict Jose Padilla from a news conference in Moscow, which was quite remarkable at that time. And ultimately, Padilla gave up and pled guilty to other charges. But the case that was articulated by Ashcroft was never brought to court and certainly didn't hold up to close scrutiny. So on that basis, while I don't sympathize with the expressions of al-Awlaki, he has rights as an American citizen. And the idea that we can target him for assassination by a drone squad or by other operatives in a foreign country is deeply offensive. And recently, the ACLU took this issue to court, and the judge ruled in favor of the Obama administration, and a brief supplied by Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA, a man who I know and respect from his time in Congress, and I used to talk to him on a regular basis. But I am shocked that, number one, the administration would make these arguments that this is too secret to even be brought to court. The policy, not even the individual case, but just the policy cannot be brought to court, and that the judge ruled in favor of that specious argument. I'm stunned.
And you should be. You know, there are three things to pay attention here, and I think you drew attention to each of them. The first is that to order the extrajudicial assassination of someone with no process at all, let alone due process, is a fundamental betrayal of all of the values undergirding the Constitution. Remember, when the Constitution was written, we just revolted against an executive that was essentially unaccountable. The reason we have a Fifth Amendment and a Sixth Amendment, the right to due process, the right to counsel, is to make sure that people are not falsely designated. Now, you know, I also have no sympathies with this particular individual. The danger here is that by allowing the precedent of the executive to just declare people persona non grata subject to assassination, it's where that precedent leads, right? And we have no way of knowing whether or not these sorts of assassinations are legitimate unless the concerns that justify them are aired in court. That's what criminal trials are supposed to be for. And so it is terrifying to me because I don't think there's any limit. Once we open the door to these kinds of executive abuses, there is no way to curtail them. It is an open invitation to executives, essentially, to assassinate. I hesitate to conjecture what the limits are, but I mean, it's not a long road to saying that it's from there that you're assassinating political enemies, right? I mean, this is like a banana republic, not the United States. I mean, to claim to be even part of the free world with authorities like that, let alone its leader, I think is a bit of a stretch. I'd also say, in this case, the implication of the state secrets privilege is really troubling, right? Because it's not just the case that they're asserting an untenable substantive authority, they're also trying to keep the standard under which it's exercised secret from the public. And this goes back to, for instance, the FBI guidelines and the undercover infiltration standard being secret, or the warrantless wiretapping scheme by the NSA, and the state secrets privilege used to block cases challenging it from court.
And extended by the Obama administration beyond even the breathtaking standard that Bush tried to assert.
That's right, yeah, sovereign immunity, basically implicated as a further ground on which to claim state secrets, and the Jeppesen case, which implicates the private corporations participating and facilitating the CIA's torture program. So whether it's torture, whether it's surveillance, whether it's undercover infiltration, whether it's extrajudicial assassination, across all of these very troubling independent areas, the Obama administration has been declaring secrecy in violation, I think, of its pledge to be an open government. And it really does compromise democratic transparency and legitimacy. The last thing I'd say here is that the judicial acquiescence to this executive claim represents a complete abdication of the role of an independent judiciary. The reason the Constitution exists is so that courts can check executives when they go over the line. And here we have, in multiple instances, executives run amok of both parties, right? So this is not a partisan criticism. This is a criticism of the executive branch, I fear, institutionally, because now that it's happened under two administrations, I don't see where this ever stops. This isn't something we can stop with an election, right? It doesn't. What I read from this is that it doesn't matter who's in the White House. It's the intelligence agencies that are driving this, and the president cannot control them. I don't need to belabor the point here, but the Washington Post this summer ran a story in which both the Secretary of Defense and the head of the CIA, who you noted, both of them claim not to have a grip on the intelligence agencies. Nobody knows everything that's happening. How is it that in a democracy we have secret agencies pursuing secret authorities that are known neither to the Congress nor the public, that the judiciary is actively shielding from disclosure to the public, and that the executive is just allowed to run amok? I mean, it is beyond troubling, and I think your use of the word fascism was absolutely accurate. This is what it looks like. It doesn't have to have the same trappings, right? Fascism is not gas chambers. Fascism is a government run amok. And that's exactly what we're dealing with today, and I do fear, certainly, what comes in the future.
Finally, Shahid, you referenced earlier John Yoo and Jay Bybee, who were the architects of the torture program. And Jack Goldsmith, who was slightly better on these issues, who cringed at the poor legal reasoning offered by John Yoo in particular, and tried to rewrite those policies and try to walk back the Bush administration from the most egregious elements of legalized torture. He wrote an astounding op-ed in the New York Times on October 10th, and he was referencing the case of a man accused of being a part of the 1998 embassy bombings in East Africa named Gailani. And the headline speaks volumes. It says, "Don't try terrorists, lock them up." And he argues that without any evidence, without a trial, that's simply based on his belief that Mr. Gailani was a part of this this coordinated terrorist assault on American interests in East Africa a decade ago, that we should simply lock him up forever. He writes, "Military detention was once legally controversial, but now is not. District and appellate judges have repeatedly ruled, most recently on Thursday, that Congress, in its September 2001 authorization of force, empowered the president to detain members of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and associated forces until the end of the military conflict." And he goes on to say that it's an indefinite conflict, so screw it. Just lock them up, and who cares about process, justice, and rights, much less the implications that it communicates to the rest of the world about the kind of banana republic that we have become.
I think you're absolutely right to seize on that. The AUMF was an authorization to bomb Afghanistan, not to create an alternative system of justice and carry it into perpetuity. That is just an absolutely contorted reading of the congressional document. That's exactly, unfortunately, what's come to grip the courts. And I think Goldsmith's move here, it is disappointing to come from someone like him. You know, he is basically like the kinder, gentler face of the Bush-era fascism. And the idea that he claims, you know, don't try terrorists, lock them up, that he claims that to be sufficient, I think is problematic for several reasons, the first of which is the role of courts in checking the executive branch. The reason there's a Fifth Amendment, the reason there's a Sixth Amendment, is so that we can have confidence that the people we are sending to prison or what have you have done something wrong. Without an opportunity to contest evidence, without an opportunity to confront witnesses, we can't have any assurance that the executive branch has the right people. And you can go back to the early days of Guantanamo, when Cheney and Rumsfeld and others claimed to have the worst of the worst at Guantanamo Bay. We know since then that that was a complete lie. Most of the prisoners that have come through Guantanamo Bay have been cleared for release. Many of them have been cleared for release, but, as supported by Goldsmith, remain under detention, even though there's been no showing to any impartial arbiter that they actually pose a security threat. There's a really fascinating movie that was recently released. I'd recommend to anyone, a half-hour short called The Response by Sigler-Bowitz and some others. Asif Manzvi stars in it. And it's a very compelling depiction, essentially generalized, but drawn from transcripts of combatant status review tribunals at Guantanamo Bay. And the character in the movie essentially claims to be an engineer who had a team that was demolishing buildings in order to build new buildings. Someone on his team, unbeknownst to him, had claimed that he was supporting militants. He's picked up some, you know, by some authorities, like Pakistani military, who are paid a bribe, basically, to turn him over. Nobody has the name of whoever, you know, claims that he was a terrorist. There's no evidence to support the claim that he's a terrorist. There's just somebody somewhere, someone at some point said, and that's the extent of it. And now a lot of these people have been held for, you know, going on a decade. Whether it's arbitrary detention without trial, whether it's extrajudicial assassination, we have courts for a reason. We have courts for a very important reason. We fought a revolution so that we would have them to protect us from executives that don't have an interest really in public safety, but rather an interest in abusing their office. It's not just the case either that we need courts for internal to domestic legitimacy. You're correct to note what the message is to the rest of the world. For us to win the battle for hearts and minds that underlies the war on terrorism, we need for the rulings of the adjudicative mechanisms to be perceived internationally as having legitimacy. The world knows that we have been imprisoning for a decade without trial and torturing at least a great many innocent people, in addition to whomever else may or may not have done something at Guantanamo Bay. We won't know, of course, because there aren't any courts to try them.
That's Shahid Buttar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, their website, bordc.org. Here's a disturbing news story that was sent to me by our listener and film review contributor, Gary Chu, in Sacramento. It was published by the Associated Press on October 16th, Dateline San Francisco. And it reads, Yasir Afifi, a 20-year-old computer salesman and community college student, took his car in for an oil change earlier this month, and his mechanic spotted an odd wire hanging from the undercarriage. The wire was attached to a strange magnetic device that puzzled Afifi and the mechanic. They pulled it off the car, posted images of it online asking for help in identifying it. 2 days later, FBI agents arrived at Afifi's Santa Clara apartment, that's in Silicon Valley, and demanded the return of their property. A GPS, or Global Positioning System, tracking device, now at the center of a raging legal debate over privacy rights. One federal judge wrote that the widespread use of the device was straight out of George Orwell's 1984, and that's from a conservative, Alex Kaczynski. Quote, by holding that this kind of surveillance doesn't impair an individual's reasonable expectation of privacy, this judicial panel hands the government the power to track the movements of every one of us every day of our lives, wrote Alex Kaczynski, chief judge of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. That was in a blistering dissent in which a 3-judge panel from his court had ruled that search warrants weren't necessary for GPS tracking. But other federal and state courts have come to the opposite conclusion. Law enforcement advocates for the devices say GPS can eliminate time-consuming stakeouts and old-fashioned tails with unmarked police cars. The technology had a starring role in the HBO cops and robbers series The Wire, and police use it to track every type of suspect, from terrorists to thieves stealing copper from air conditioners. That investigators don't need a warrant to use GPS tracking devices in California troubles privacy advocates, technophiles, criminal defense attorneys, and others. The federal appeals court based in Washington, D.C. said in August that investigators must obtain a warrant for a GPS in tossing out the conviction and life sentence of Antoine Jones, a nightclub owner convicted of operating a cocaine distribution ring. That court concluded that the accumulation of 4 weeks' worth of data collected from a GPS on Jones's Jeep amounted to a search that required a search warrant. Judge Douglas Ginsburg said watching Jones's Jeep for an entire month rather than, say, trailing him made all the difference between surveilling a suspect on public property and a search that needs a court order. So this is very interesting. We don't know exactly why Mr. Afifi was subject to an FBI GPS tracking system. His lawyer is pessimistic that he has much of a chance to file a successful lawsuit against the FBI. Afifi is represented by Zahra Bilou of the Council on Islamic American Relations. Afifi has declined comment after spending last week fielding many media inquiries after Wired.com posts the story. Still, his attorney said Afifi was targeted because of his extensive ties to the Middle East, which include supporting two brothers who live in Egypt and making frequent overseas trips. His father was a well-known Islamic American community leader who died last year in Egypt. So the FBI can now, without a warrant, attach a surveillance device to your car. And this is part of the creeping police state that Shahid Buttar and I were talking about just a few moments ago. Also, I want to acknowledge that what I'm about to tell you comes from a listener, and I have not been able to independently verify it. But she writes, I'm writing as a victim of preemptive prosecution, or what I've begun to call a contemporary form of the third degree. Contrary to the impression that many people seem to have this type of behavior, think that it's limited to the FBI, it's been my experience that local law enforcement and their agents do most of the heavy lifting. And this correspondent sent me a detailed letter suggesting that his or her home was subjected to excessive aerial surveillance. And this person has documented that prior to a certain point in time, there were only occasional planes or other aerial vehicles flying over the home, and that has sharply increased, particularly during times when the residents were expected to be asleep and when their privacy would be expected to be respected. And this is not the first of this type of communication that I've received. And while I cannot prove what these people assert, I think that the pattern of their reports is worth noting. And if you have been subjected to what you consider to be extra-legal tactics by law enforcement officials, either the FBI or local officials, I invite you to tell me your story. Send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com, and tell me your story. As I say, I can't independently prove these reports, but I have started to get many of them, and so I have to suspect that these are not crazy people or people who are concocting these stories. And just one more item. Gary Chu also sent an item, a news item, off a tech website that notes that the Canon company that makes copying machines has just released a new copy machine called the Uniflow 5, and that it has a keyword security system that blocks the printing of documents if keywords show up. And this uses what's called OCR, optical character recognition, to essentially censor the documents that are passing through that copying machine. Now, when you think about it, at first, what's the big deal? Okay, a big company doesn't want certain types of documents copied on its machines. But this could also be used to red flag documents that contain certain key words that are subject to data mining. And when you link this to the massive surveillance and interception of our telephone calls and our email traffic by the National Security Agency, which started under Bush and continues unabated under President Obama, with the extra rubber stamp of the FISA reform law that Obama voted for after promising he wouldn't in August of 2008 as he was heading into the final stretch of the presidential campaign and was a United States senator. So I want you to be aware of these things because Big Brother has many different ways of monitoring what we're doing. Telephone calls, emails, copy machines, or a secret GPS device installed on your automobile. Be careful, because Big Brother could be watching you when you least suspect it. The Peter B. Collins Show is sponsored by Cinema Classics, a movie company specializing in classic Hollywood and foreign films. Check out their 30% off sale and their great collection of old movies on DVD and VHS. Just click on the link at peterbcollins.com. And hey, I'll get you free shipping on any order. All you have to do is enter PBC in the comments section of their website order form. Up next, I want to share two snippets of commentary from Colonel Ann Wright. She's been on our program many times before, and she is a courageous advocate on many fronts. She has fought for women in the military subjected to rape and sexual harassment. She has, she resigned her State Department post in protest of George Bush's invasion of Iraq in 2003. She was also on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla that was intercepted and attacked by Israeli forces on May 31st of this year. And that's what you'll first hear her talk about. And then she offers a description of the expert witness testimony that she gave recently in Las Vegas, Nevada, in a federal court trial about 14 protesters who were accused of trespassing on the Creech Air Force Base outside Las Vegas. This is the same base where the drone attacks that occur in Afghanistan and Pakistan are remote controlled from. And we covered the issue of the Creech 14 in a podcast in September. Here is Colonel Ann Wright first talking about the Gaza Freedom Flotilla.
One, of course, when one was, when you see your friends falling down a pool of blood, no wonder that those videos that we saw, or you all saw first, I saw them 4 days later when I got to Istanbul, but I was kind of shocked at the level of violence in terms of the passengers beating up the commandos, because we had all said we were going to have resistance, but it was going to be nonviolent resistance, and when I saw that, it was like, uh-oh, what happened? I mean, those guys are really wailing the bejesus out of some of those commandos. Yeah. But now we know it was because they had seen people wounded and probably already dead. It's a human reaction. Yeah. That's right. But what we didn't see was the beginning of it from the Israeli film. You know, that the Israelis did not show us that there was gunfire coming from their helicopters, nor did they show us how it ended, where the captain of the ship and the director of the International Humanitarian Organization, the Turkish organization that had hired the Mavi Marmara, that they came out of the wheelhouse with bullhorns and were shouting at people, stop, stop, beating up the commandos, take the ones that are injured, take them downstairs, get them treatment, don't hold anyone captive. We want to give everybody back to the commandos because we already have their people wounded and perhaps even dead on board. And we don't want any more of that. And they were calling also on the radio to the Israeli ships to say, you guys, you're killing people here. You know, we don't have any way to take care of anyone. We're a civilian ship. We have a small first aid station. I mean, and what are you doing shooting people? You know? So that part of it, that within 20 minutes they were in full control of the ship. When the captain came on the PA system on the ship to say, stop any sort of resistance. They are killing people. Stop anything that you're doing. Put down any sticks you may have. Put it down because they are shooting people. And over those 20 minutes in the videos that I'll show you part of tonight, but if you look at the hour and 25 minutes that Yara Lee, an American documentarian that was on board the ship, and she was able to get off one of two video clips. They were able to get it off. Everybody else's, I mean, people were taking stuff out, trying to hide them. I'm not saying. I'm not telling. Because we're going to need it again. I'm not saying. We're not, because we're going to need, we are on the next flotilla, the Israelis will board it again, I have no doubt. And we want to get the evidence off of what they did. So we only have two of those film cards out of hundreds, thousands of them. Every person of those 750 people that were on board the six ships, everyone had a camera, a cell phone, a computer. They took them all. They took it. That was the first thing they wanted. They demanded, they ordered, give us everything. And people were trying to hide these things, and they over the next many hours, every place we went, we were patted down, we were searched, because they were still looking. Yeah.
Well, they wanted to establish the narrative, and they did, because they put their edited videos out before any of the footage you're talking about could have been released to the rest of the world. And they you know, selectively edited the scenes of some of the passengers who had sticks or parts of furniture. But of course, and they also heavily used the sequence where one soldier was thrown overboard, one of the Israelis.
Actually, he wasn't thrown overboard. He went over from the top level of the ship down to the next level. Not that it was an easy, I mean, he got shoved over, and no doubt that hurt a lot, but he was not thrown overboard.
But Israel created the perception that their soldiers who assaulted this ship in international waters were victims.
Were the victims. They did. In fact, I've talked to people who were in Israel as the flotilla was being attacked, and they were saying it was unbelievable what the Israeli media was saying, that our guys are the victims. They're just going in peace, you know, they were just going to stop the ships, and then all of a sudden they were being attacked, and they gloriously and valiantly defended themselves, but they were the victims on this. And what a bunch of crap was that?
Yeah,
I mean, then certainly there was some resistance. There was Marvi Marmara and several of the cargo ships, the passengers and the crew hooked up some of the firefighting equipment that is connected to salt water, and they were pouring lots of water down onto the commandos' boats to the extent that the boats were about to sink. So they had to push the boats away, and that's when they said, you've got to bring in helicopters, because these pesky passengers and crew are resisting us. Well, but by international law, I mean, for the pirates off Somalia, that's exactly what all the NATO forces are saying to the ships that are going past there. If these pirates try to board you, first, you know, pour all this water down on them. Maybe you can sink their little boats. And so that's what we were doing. And for the Israeli pirates that were coming on board, they couldn't get on that ship because they had to throw ropes up to get on board. On our little ship that was boarded, it took them about 20 seconds to gain control. I was on the Challenger, and it was a small ship. They could bring theirs right up beside and almost on a parallel height, and so they were just able to climb on. Although we had our own resistance out there. We had women that were standing around the rails because we knew if we had guys out there, there would be major confrontations, and we were going to put women out there yelling at the commandos, we're in international waters, get off our ship, you don't have any right to get on them, and and just see what they would do. And that's where we had one woman that was shot dead in the middle of the face with a paint bullet. We had another woman that was tasered completely across the roof of the ship. She was a photojournalist from Australia. And we had people thrown on the floor, faces rubbed in the glass that had been broken out of all the windows because of the percussion grenades that they had shot. And every place they were brutal. If you look at the last ship that tried to go in, the Irene, the Jewish ship, that there were all Jewish members of the Jewish faith on board. There were two former IDF, Israeli Defense Force soldiers, that are now combatants for peace. They refused to fight for Israel, and so they've now traveled all over the world talking about being a non-combatant or refusing to go along with what Israel's doing. Well, it was well known that they were on board this ship. Their former colleagues from the IDF grabbed both of them, put one guy on their military ship immediately, but while still on the Irene, the other fellow, Yonatan Shapira, his life jacket was pulled off of him, and they tasered him right in the chest, right in the heart area. So, you know, they're... Yeah. So, it was a very brutal, unnecessary, forcefully conducted stopping of those ships. There were plenty of other ways. All they wanted to do was stop the ships. There were other ways to do it without killing people. But they wanted Israel being the little cocky, you can't, you know, nobody can do anything to us. We will take you down. And even though we've got the biggest military, the strongest military, we will take down peaceful, nonviolent civilians, and we'll just show you something. We'll kill you, just as they do Palestinians every single day. So.
And could I change the subject and ask you to talk about the trial of the Creech 14 in Las Vegas?
Yeah. Well, the Creech 14 trial about 2.5 weeks ago, I was there as an expert witness along with former Attorney General Ramsey Clark and Bill Quigley, who's the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And then I was there as a person who's been in the military and knows the military regulations and such things. We did not anticipate that the state level, the court judge, would allow us to testify, because in none of the trials that we've been having for people stepping over a line in a military installation or a federal installation have we ever been able to have expert witnesses. But for some reason this time, this judge, who's been on the bench 25 years, that day he was telling us, that was his 21st anniversary as a judge, I think it was probably because he'd never had a former attorney general in his court before, and he wanted to hear what Ramsey Clark had to say. So we despite the prosecution's protest for us to be qualified as expert witnesses, he allowed us to speak, and we talked sequentially for about 4 hours. And at the end of all of this, and we were talking about the responsibility of citizens to challenge policies of a government, but we couldn't say drone policies. That was the one thing. He said, what this is about is trespass on a federal installation. It's not about drones. And of course, from our perspective, it's all about the drones. But he was not going to put the drones on trial in his courtroom. What he was going to do was to talk about trespass.
And wasn't it a necessity defense that you raised?
Absolutely. That it is the responsibility of citizens to challenge when we know that the government is doing something wrong. I mean, it's the Nuremberg principle, that if you see your nation doing something that's criminal, illegal, it is your responsibility not to cooperate with it and to challenge it. And so that's what these 14 people were doing at Creech Air Force Base. They were going on to the base to give a letter to the commanding officer saying, we firmly believe that the use of these drones is unlawful, it's killing innocent civilians, and we as Americans want this stopped. But that was not what was put on trial. It was that they stepped across an arbitrary line. Well, we were able to use a little bit of ingenuity and creativity in how we talked about that so that none of our testimony was disqualified. And talking about how it is a responsibility, for example, for mine, I was saying that military have, they have degrees of discretion of what they can do. And they can allow citizens to come on board on the base. They don't have to arrest them. They can talk to them. They can receive messages from them. They can call the commanding officer and say, these people out here, these Americans want to come talk to you. That you don't have to arrest people. And that the arrest was an abuse of power, really. And that these people should not be penalized because that young sergeant decided he would arrest people when he could have just as easily, and it's been done in other cases, that people are allowed to come on the base. And then Ramsey Clark was talking about the that even though that there are regulations that control a lot of our lives, for example, you normally cannot go into a person's house unless you're invited. But if you see a house on fire and you see a kid up on the top floor, and do you stop and say, do I have permission to come in? No, it's an emergency. It's a necessity. You go help them. And that's the way we feel about this. It's the necessity to speak out on criminal acts of our government, that we should be able to go into the burning house and save the nation from what the government is doing to the nation. So the judge, at the end of it, you know, usually the judge would say, well, I'm going to rule that I'm either going to find you guilty or not guilty. The defendants chose not to testify. They had actually planned earlier they would each interrogate each other to kind of bring out what had happened, but knowing full well that the judge was probably going to cut off the testimony at the moment they said drone. So they decided not to testify, and they let the case stand on the testimony of the three of us expert witnesses. And at the end of this, the judge said, well, you know, there are other issues besides just simple trespass here, and that I am going to take several months, 4 months, to evaluate this. I'm going to investigate, I'm going to do research on it, and I will come back in 4 months and give you my decision. Well, for us, that was a victory. Yeah, that indeed he's at least, we've had a judge that says there's more to it than just trespass. So whatever happens 4 months from now, you know, we'll deal with that then, but at least we're in a bit of a elation. We've got elation now because at least a judge has said there's more to it than just simple trespass.
As citizens, we're entitled to interact with the army and our soldiers of our country. Is that what the army does?
That can be...
They are us, anyway.
Yeah, right. And that the fact, even though that, I mean, soldiers do have specific orders, and if they're the gate guards, they've got orders that, you know, they prevent people that they suspicion may be trying to do harm to anyone.
But in this case,
yeah, on this, I mean, we had priests and full priest regalia. We had, the average age of this group was probably 75. It wasn't like there were young militant fighters there. Father Louis Vitale was there. Father Steve Kelly was there. Father Jerry Zawada was there. Father John Deere, Kathy Kelly, Sister Megan Rice, Sister Ann Montgomery. It really was. And they knew who it all was because press releases were put out beforehand that listed all of the people that would be coming to the gate to appeal to them to please let us present this letter to the commanding officer of the base.
And finally on today's podcast, a lighter moment, a little whimsy from humorous satirist comedian Will Durst, who has a fantasy campaign to run for lieutenant governor of an unnamed state. Take it away, Will.
Hey guys, Will Durst here, your candidate for lieutenant governor from the state of confusion. To warn you about one of the most deadly conspiracies ever foisted on the American public, milk. because of his close ties to out-of-state dairy bosses. My opponent doesn't want you to know this, but milk is responsible for more damage to this country than any other liquid. And he continues to support milk subsidies. Think of it. Our military forced to kill the enemies of freedom using outdated technologies just so special interests like public school children can drink milk. This isn't just about milk, but its subversive partners as well, butter and cheese, not to mention sour cream. Milk causes phlegm, bloating, and the humiliation of adults photographed wearing milk mustaches. Experts agree that milk is a gateway drug. It is a proven fact that 99% of all heroin users started their descent into hell by first abusing milk. Ask yourself, where does milk come from? Cows. Passive, yet ubiquitous, scattered all over the countryside, just watching and waiting like bovine sleeper cells. Mad cow disease? That's milk in a nutshell. What about female human breasts? Do I have to tell you how obscene and contrary to everything pure they are? No, I didn't think so. The opposition calls it the perfect food. But you know what happens if you drink 3 gallons a day? You'll die. At first glance, it may seem innocuous enough with that soft white milky appearance, but think how quickly this substance turns dark by the simple addition of chocolate. Don't be fooled. Pasteurized is just another way of saying fluoridated. So from now on, when you see one of those Got Milk ads, just remember, it might as well read, Got Communist Poison? And if you vote for my opponent, you'll have it in spades. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst, and I approve this ad.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Hang on to your civil rights and send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.